You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 19th, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
And back from his whirlwind tour of Italy, Jay.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Salutations and felicitations.
So, Jay, welcome back.
We missed you.
Oh, my God. I feel like I haven't sat down and done a show for what? It's been over a month now, a month and a half?
Yeah, because we had all the live shows and everything.
So yeah.
Jay, let's cut to the chase. Best meal in Italy. What was it?
Well, by far, Rome had the best food.
Yeah.
You know, I was in Venice. I was in Florence. I spent some time in Tuscany, and then I was in Rome. And the food got better as I went south. I absolutely loved this trip. It was absolutely the best trip I've ever taken in my life. It was it was phenomenal. Everything about it. The art and culture is everywhere. It's in every corner of every city in Italy, and even, you know, a lot of the smaller towns, you know, have fantastic works of art that are just priceless and so beautiful. Like, you really do a reality check. Living in the United States, we're very, very dry on art like this. Like, we don't have it. We don't have that much of it. And it's very much in the cities, and there's not much else to be found. And even the landscape in Tuscany was another thing. And I didn't know this, but the landscape in Tuscany was mostly worked by hand. I thought it was just the way that it was there. But really, you know, it's the farmland. Everywhere they're growing grapes, and they're growing olives and a lot of other crops too that I didn't know about. You know, then Rome is very much in your face. There's a lot of people. A ton of people. It was a sea of people everywhere, and everybody is sightseeing and shopping and eating and walking around. And Courtney and I went into St. Peter's, and we looked at Michelangelo's Pietà. Literally, we started crying when we saw it. It's so unbelievably striking when you see it, how beautiful it is. And you cannot see it in a picture.
Right.
You look at a picture, and it just washes the whole thing out. I mean, when you're there, well, that would be amazing. It would be awesome to catalog all this stuff. Of course, I'm having these incredible geeky thoughts like, you know, if there's a massive earthquake, you know, how well did they take pictures of these things, and are they doing anything to preserve them three-dimensionally? And I was thinking of stuff like that, Steve, because there's just so much of it.
Well, that's been reproduced several times for different museums around the world.
And, you know, I just can't say enough about how emotional it is to see the art and to see how old things are, and you know, you're reading about everything before you go and after you go, you know, and I found out so much about Italy I didn't know, and I thought I knew quite a bit about Italian culture and the art and everything, but just, you know, you just take one artist, you know, like I was really paying attention to all the things that Michelangelo had done all over Italy, you know, just everywhere you go, and I thought I was a huge fan of his work, and now I'm just so emotionally attached to everything that he's done that I saw, and you know, I was already looking things up on the internet here. I'm like, oh God, I just wish I had more time and more money to do these types of things.
Speaking of looking up on the internet, I just looked up a particular statue, and to correct myself, the replicas didn't go to museums; they all went to churches and cathedrals around the world, and one was actually used as a model in reconstruction of the original after damage in 1972.
Oh. What do you know?
Some loser like jumped on it and started hacking away at it.
Really? Is that what happened?
Yeah. Jay, it was behind glass. When I was there a long time ago, it was behind glass. You couldn't even get close to it.
Yeah, it was behind plexiglass. Like, the center portion was open. But you're far away from it. You can't get right up on it anymore. And somebody also took a hammer to David, the statue David.
What?
Yeah. They broke off one of the toes, and it was. Remember?
Oh my God!
The story was that the guy was told by God to do it, and he was a frustrated artist, And, you know, he was, like, emotionally really losing it, and he damaged the statue, and, they, you know, they repaired it now. But that's the that's another piece of artwork that when you see it, the whole room fades away. I mean, it's striking.
Jay. Reality fades away. That was all this – when I toured Italy, that was one of the most memorable things. Of all the things I saw, that's the one that my jaw just dropped, and I just didn't move for, like, 15 minutes just staring at it. It was just so magnificent. Incredible.
The actual most pseudoscientific experience I had was the actual limo ride home from the airport last
really?
Night.
Oh my god! Yeah, getting back to America, you experienced it.
We get in the car and he right away starts talking to me about vaccinations. I mean, my wife was reading online and just wanted to talk about something. The guy like was desperate for conversation.
And that's what he chose. That's odd.
It's I know. So. I'm sitting there and I'm like, dude, you don't know who you have in the backseat right now. You just don't know who you're talking to. So I let him talk. I let him dig himself in pretty good for about 15 minutes. And then I'm like, okay. Dude. I'm like, let's go back to the 1990s and let's talk about a man named Andrew Wakefield. And I started there and I finished after a two-hour ride from JFK back home. I talk most of the time.
You gave a two-hour lecture on vaccines.
And I explained to him how, you know, if you look for something on the internet, you know, you could pretty much find confirmation for any belief that you want just because it's on there, and you have to be very critical on your sources. And, you know, and he had this big chip on his shoulder about not trusting doctors. And I'm like, well, okay, sure. You know, all medical doctors aren't good, and you need to be critical on who your doctor is, of course. And, you know, these experts, and all they care about are giving you medication. And I'm like, why would a doctor only care about giving you medication? You know, that whole talk about how, you know, indeed most doctors are, you know, have no gain from prescribing one drug over another. And, you know, and he's like, you know, they don't know that vinegar can cure so many things. And I'm like, I said, you know, why would you say that? You know, why, you know, so I even went in, I'm like, I'm questioning his methodology. You know, how are you coming to that conclusion? Why do you believe the things that you're saying right now? You know,
yeah.
We went everywhere. We had a great conversation. And then at the end, as we're about to pull into the driveway, he came out with like the total like conversation eraser that we've all had. Where, like, you know, you spend this whole time talking to the person, and then as if the conversation didn't take place, he just said, like, one more thing, and I'm like, oh, God, is this time to collapse now? Like, I'm not going there.
So you didn't make any headway?
I tried, but...
Well, you might have.
Maybe you,
know,
you planted never, a seed. Yeah, you never
Yeah,
know.
You can never tell in the moment. They're never going to just
thought.
Be like, oh, you're right, you know.
Thanks, Jay. Let's, Evan, do our This Day in Skepticism before we move on to some news items.
Yep. So the culmination of 14 months' worth of testing came to a crescendo on October 21st, 1879, when in the laboratories of Thomas Alva Edison, he and his team of engineers finally found a way to create an incandescent light bulb of sufficient illumination duration, which at the time was 13 and a half hours, and that was significantly longer than its closest competitor. So it's marked as the day that the incandescent light bulb was effectively, as we know it, invented.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
He found a way to make it practical.
And man, did he use the brute force method in trying to discover that. Do you know how many?
Tested everything.
Is it 1,000 or 10,000? 10,000, I think.
He thought that he and his team would be at this for roughly 3 months to figure it out. It took 14 months. He and 40 researchers had to bang their heads against the wall for over a year.
Well, but they spent years just systematically going through every material that they could think of to make a filament out of, but they kept burning out until he found
cotton compressed to carbon.
Tungsten came later.
Tungsten came in 1910, and that, you know, that revolutionized everything. Now, shortly after his experiment in this 13.5-hour bulb came along, he and his team did some experimenting with bamboo, compressing bamboo down into a carbon strip, and that filament lasted 1,200 hours.
Whoa.
Wow. And not that it needs to be said, but for a moment, just think about how profound that is and how much it changed things. I mean... to have a very strong light that you can turn on at any time. Like, we take that so for granted.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
What about gas light, though? Didn't it take a while to supplant actual gas lighting?
Well, yeah, you needed the
infrastructure was already in place.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's not like overnight, oh, yeah, let's switch to this. I mean, it actually took longer than you would think.
No, generations, actually, because they were making lights illuminate with gases for, you know, decades prior to that. But they couldn't make it affordable. They couldn't make it practical until finally it came to be by Edison and his team.
Well, let's move on to some news items. A few weeks ago, there was a news story going around about neutrinos moving faster than light. And we're still getting emails from people asking us to cover this news item. Actually, we did cover it during the 24-hour live show. We had a long conversation with Phil Plait about it. That show has been online for a while, and we'll be actually making it available as well, an edited and post-produced, you know, improved version of it. But there has been a little bit of an update in this story, so it's a good opportunity to give a recap of this, Bob.
Yeah, so this was I knew this was coming, but it looks like those pesky superluminal neutrinos may be subluminal after all. And you can kind of predict that, although there was always this hope of new physics, but not faster than light physics. But I'm sure you guys all remember the announcement, like Steve said, from physicists at CERN when they declared that they measured neutrinos traveling a tiny bit faster than the speed of light. A blogger at D-Vice had a great quote. He's like, "Physics, we have a problem." And that... God, how many neutrino jokes did I see about that? I was, you know, after the 10th, I was just like, okay, I've seen this joke 100 times. Thank you very much. But this is actually a big deal, even if it might not quite seem that way, because this type of change would throw much of modern physics into disarray. Causality would essentially go out the window. And I don't know about you, but I don't want to live in a universe where effect can precede cause. Call me silly. It's kind of funny then that the theory that this discovery would have overturned relativity has recently been shown to hit right back and really hard. Now, very briefly, scientists at CERN spent 3 years shooting a beam of neutrinos through the Earth from Switzerland to Italy. Jay, did you see any neutrinos while you were in Italy? you probably did, just didn't notice. But the neutrinos, you remember those ghostly particles with a tiny bit of mass that travel close to the speed of light and through matter like it were essentially nothing. Now, after about 15,000 experiments, which I think is more than what Edison did for his light bulb, they felt they reached a level of statistical confidence to make this formal announcement of their findings and have other scientists vet it. Now, these findings were that these particles were arriving at the detectors 60 billionths of a second early, which means that they'd have to travel a little bit faster of light since they travel so close to the speed of light anyway. So of course, people were declaring that time machines were right around the corner. It's like, you know, they just bought it hook, line, and sinker, and they just jumped to the conclusion that, yeah, this is valid, and this is where we're at. But I mean, like I said, I wasn't really worried about it. I suspect that there had to be some subtle error in their calculations. It just seemed overwhelming.
You know what's funny, Bob?
Yeah.
That you're right, though. A lot of the cranks or even just people who are supporting other outrageous theories who started bringing this up. Like, oh, yeah, well, like for example, there was a comment discussion on a homeopathy article, and one of the defenders of homeopathy was saying, yeah, well, they just because homeopathy violates the laws of physics doesn't mean anything. What about those neutrinos they discovered that violate the laws of physics and go faster than light?
Oh, man.
And somebody responded, yeah, exactly. What about them? That's why the whole scientific community responded with, you know, we don't believe it. There's got to be something wrong. This is really extraordinary. You know, we would need a ton of evidence in order to accept this as true.
And I think that even the researchers themselves who put out the paper they put it out because they were pretty sure there must be something wrong there. And sending it out for peer review is the way to find that out as quickly as possible.
No, their approach was basically help us figure out what we're doing wrong because we can't find it.
Right. And if it turns out, if in the very unlikely possibility that there is new physics here, that's great. But I'm sure all of them, if they had to put money on it, would have thought, well, yeah, there's probably some quirky thing that we haven't thought about. And you know, with stuff like this, it just seems so much more likely that's exactly what it was. That physics was not going to be completely overturned, and that it was just some little thing that they had neglected. And you really shouldn't deride them. You shouldn't ride them too hard, because they, from what I gather, they did some good science, and they really dotted all their I's and crossed all their T's. But you know, nobody's perfect, and this, you know, this isn't definitive anyway. We're still not 100% sure what went on, but it's not like these guys were just like mucking around, like, hey, look what we discovered, type of thing. I mean, 15,000 experiments, that's a lot of experiments. Now, one very good early hint that there was something wrong with this research, and I was kind of bummed that I didn't think of this. Because I was aware that there was a supernova in 1987 that went off, and I think it was one of the Magellanic clouds. One of the ways that we detected it was the neutrinos that hit the detectors, like, I think 3 hours before any of the photons did, and that's because since photons don't have any charge, I mean, since neutrinos don't have any charge, they just, when the supernova happens, they're created and released in vast numbers, but the photons, they just, you know, they're bouncing around, they're getting absorbed and reabsorbed, and it takes them a little while to actually get going. So if you see a lot of these neutrinos heading your way from space, then that's a pretty good indication that there was actually a supernova that went off. So if you look at that, if you just kind of know that, and you think about this study that they came out with, these OPERA researchers came out with, if they were correct, then that would mean that the neutrinos from the 1987 supernova should have arrived 4 years before the photons did it, but it really only was a few hours. That kind of decreases the likelihood significantly in my eyes that these neutrinos were arriving a little bit faster than they should have.
Isn't that a deal killer? I mean, that seems like it's not a nail in the coffin of that claim.
Yeah, it pretty much is. But then, you know, you look at all the search these guys have done for 3 years, and it still cries out for an explanation. But I didn't really come across a lot of people saying, well, here it is. Why do we even need to examine this even more? But you're right. That one, it really does kick it to the curb. And it's like, well, yeah, how do you explain that? But most recently, the preprint server, the archive server, there's like 80 alternative explanations that they're coming out with, that they've been coming out with. And the coolest one that I came across was the idea that the particles were traveling through extra dimensions. That would be cool, because here you've got these particles and they're not traveling faster than the speed of light, but it would also demonstrate that, yeah, there are extra dimensions that they're traveling through. And there's been lots of speculation about that for years, and there's just no one's really come up with an experiment to definitively show that. And this would have been cool if it turns out to be the case, although it's fairly unlikely at this point. There was a paper released that disputes this whole faster-than-light claim based on relativity. Now, the OPERA researchers used the GPS satellites to measure the distance between the detector and the neutrino origin point at CERN. Relativity says that the calculations that you use have to be different if the observers are moving relative to one another. So that means that the relationship between the satellite to the detectors and CERN, which produce the neutrinos, changes over time, and that was key. And it's kind of a little bit surprising that they didn't really consider that as fully as they should have. According to Dutch researcher Ronald Elberg, he said that from the perspective of the clock, the detector is moving towards the source, and consequently, the distance traveled by the particles or observed from the clock is shorter. So shorter here means shorter than the distance if you measured it on the ground. So because this satellite was moving relative to the observers, to the detector and CERN, that it's different than if you measure the distance from the ground. So when you plug in the numbers, which is what these researchers did, the difference came out to be almost exactly what the OPERA researchers said that the discrepancy was. And that's a huge red flag. When you take into account a physical principle and it just wipes away the error, that the discrepancy that you're talking about, it's like, okay, well, yeah, this you know, pretty bad. I mean, this is really really does a job on that theory.
Could be a coincidence, but yeah, it's confirmation be. That it still keeps it as a very plausible explanation if it is the right number, if it accounts for the discrepancy. So
yeah,
it's not looking good. I mean, I think we could say at this point in time that these neutrinos are not moving faster than the speed of light. And this is a probable explanation for the error, but we still need to hear from the original researchers, I think, about whether or not they had accounted for this. And and see if this really pans out and accounts for it. I just hope that when the final answer is agreed upon by everybody, that it gets as much press as the original story did.
You know it won't. You know it won't, but
Well, nearly exciting.
But we'll talk about it.
I mean, for how many years are we going to have to be correcting cranks who are saying that neutrinos move faster than light, so those scientists
years.
Don't know everything.
Years. The rest of our lives.
Forever.
Yeah.
Forever.
Yeah. It's done.
Well, it gives us one more thing to correct. At least we have the final trump card.
That's true.
Science.
40 years from now. Remember when we talked about those neutrinos way back when?
Right. All right. Well, thanks, Bob. There is another story that it's actually not a new bit of research. The research was done back in May, or was published in May, but Edzard Ernst wrote about a Rye-Key study recently, and I blogged about it today because I thought it was very interesting. You guys know what Rye-Key is?
I always said Reiki. Have I been saying it wrong all the time, or is this just another example of you making up your own weird
pronunciation? I think it is Reiki, actually.
Reiki.
R-A-Y-K-E-Y.
What was the other one?
You want to start over, Steve?
You want to start over, Steve?
Oh, Rifid.
Arfid. You got a problem with Arfid?
Yeah, that's right.
All right. So do you guys know what Reiki is?
Sure.
Yes.
Yes, energy healing.
It's Japanese energy healing. It's basically faith healing for Japanese. So from Reiki.org... It's a brief overview. Reiki is a Japanese technique for stress reduction and relaxation that also promotes healing. That's where they go too far, by the way. It is administered by laying on hands and is based on the idea that an unseen life force energy flows through us and is what causes us to be alive.
Now, wait a minute. I could have said all that with five letters. Magic.
Yes, magic. Yeah. It's magic. If one's life force energy is low, then we are more likely to get sick and feel stressed. And if it's high, we are more capable of being happy and healthy. So there's your quick overview. So that's basically it. It's like therapeutic touch or any other energy medicine, energy healing, you know, woo nonsense. It is popular, however, among nurses in the U.S. I'm not sure how popular it is elsewhere. In fact, it's used by nurses at my own institution, embarrassingly enough, at Yale.
Whoa. Ouch.
Yeah, it's terrible. And so I looked at the research for this as part of my research for my article. There's a recent review of the clinical research into Reiki. And essentially, the reviewers concluded that the current research is terrible. Essentially, there's only a bunch of crappy studies and you can't draw any conclusions from it, which is what I agree looking through the studies that have been done. They're poorly controlled, small studies, etc. But then, of course, they go on to conclude that, therefore, we need to do better and more research, whereas I would conclude this is implausible magic.
We can
give it up. Yeah.
You're chasing a unicorn.
Right. But there was one good study in terms of the research design that was published a few months ago, and Ernst was commenting about it recently, which is what brought my attention to it, where they did do a controlled study. They had three groups, Reiki, fake Reiki, where somebody who is not...
Fakey.
Fakey, we call it fakey, and somebody who's not trained... who just basically mimes the motions of Reiki but is not doing anything. And then no intervention. And guess what they found?
Uh-oh.
I have no idea.
Zero difference between the Reiki and the Fakey.
Shocking.
That was good, Steve.
But they were both better than, of course, the no intervention. And the outcome was the patient's subjective report of their well-being. How well did they feel? Yeah, so there was a placebo effect, but no difference between the real stuff and somebody just going through the motions and miming it. So here's the conclusion.
Shocking.
Ready? Here's the conclusion. Okay. The findings indicate that the presence of an RN providing one-on-one support during chemotherapy was influential in raising comfort and well-being levels with or without an attempted healing energy field.
Ah. So don't you wish, like, instead of putting money into more Reiki studies, we put money into empowering nurses and giving them the time and the ability to spend more quality time with patients?
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice? So I missed the part, though, where they said Reiki doesn't work. Apparently they forgot to put that in the conclusion.
Why?
That there was no effect. So I always love to make this analogy. Can you imagine a pharmaceutical study that showed no difference between the drug and placebo?
Right.
That where this is the conclusion of the study. The findings indicate that taking a pill during chemotherapy was influential in raising comfort and well-being levels with or without an active ingredient.
Right.
Talk about spin. How about it didn't freaking work? Yeah. It was no difference between treatment and placebo equals not working.
Yeah.
But they spin this constantly. You know, this is the same thing with acupuncture and homeopathy, that, oh, it's the placebo effect. It's the attention. Yeah, right. But forget the ritual placebo. Forget the thing itself. There's no physiological effect. It's adding nothing to the intervention. We don't need to prove over and over again that when you spend time with a patient, they feel better.
Yeah.
What this study showed is that Reiki has no specific effects. It doesn't work.
When you take the spin out of it, you know, you're taking all the meat out of it.
Yeah, because there is no meat. There's nothing.
Where's the beef?
That bone has been picked dry.
So what the hell is it going to take to get through to these people? I mean, did they have to definitively show a negative outcome? I mean, what is it going to take?
No, nothing, Bob. Nothing. Obviously, evidence is irrelevant.
Spontaneous combustion upon application of Reiki. That
where can
is
I sign
the
up?
Only
yeah,
thing.
But can I sign up for this?
Yeah, but that sucks.
They've proven that the evidence is irrelevant.
Welcome to what we do for a living.
I know, yeah. but every now and then I just get pissed off all over again.
Yep.
That's good, Bob. That's what keeps us going.
Sharp. Yeah. Keep you sharp.
Remember Red Dawn, that movie Red Dawn?
Yeah.
All that hate's going to burn you up, boy. Keeps me warm.
Oh, nice.
Yep.
All right.
That's good line.
That's Bob.
I like it.
So I put it to you, Steve. Why don't we just come up with a company where you can hire someone to dote on you?
You can.
I mean, yeah, it's not legal everywhere, but.
Well, let me say, there are so-called boutique practices where you can pay lots of money to have all the attention you want. It's all a matter of economics. And in fact, the reason why they're so desperate to say that Reiki does something or acupuncture does something is because you can, it's a billable thing you can do. You could say, I'm doing X therapy. I'm going to bill you for X therapy. What I'm really doing is just giving you some of my time.
Yeah.
But if you're going to try to bill an insurance company or get a hospital to support this or whatever, of I'm just going to spend more time with patients to make them feel better, no one's going to pay for that and go for it. That's the problem. So the economics is driving the nonsense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, and Edzard Ernst, just to get back to his article, he makes a specific point that it's actually unethical to recommend ineffective treatments just for the kind attention placebo effect. He says, by insisting that patients must not be treated with placebos like Reiki, scientists also advocate that they receive treatments that demonstrably work better than placebo. And in fact, to summarize what he says after that, you get the placebo effect from treatments that actually work. It's not like you don't get the attention or the benefits of it if you're doing something legitimate, right?
Right.
Yeah, they at
two for the price of one.
Yeah. Simon Singh make that point in Trick or Treatment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which I think it's a very good point.
All right. Let's go on to a happier news item. Rebecca, you're gonna tell us about ending genital mutilation.
Yeah, it's a heavier topic, but for once I think ever I can report on a bit of good news. We've talked about female genital mutilation in the past, but just for those who don't know briefly, it's a traditional practice. It involves the partial or total removal of the external female genitalia, and it's often practiced in very poor areas using unsterilized tools on girls who range anywhere from infants up to teenagers. And there are no actual health benefits to this, but there's a lot of pseudoscience and myth that suggests that it, for instance, keeps women pure, that it's cleaner, that it makes sex better for the men.
Well, at least they have their priorities straight.
Right, exactly. And the idea that it's mandated by God, which is also false because it actually predates Islam. And it's mostly practiced in Islamic areas. But it's not actually mandated by God.
Yeah, but it doesn't predate God, Rebecca.
I can't say for sure. Actually,
nobody
probably
can.
Not.
Nobody can.
You have a point there.
Well,
which God?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if we're just going with a general idea of God, then no.
Not pan, certainly.
Man probably got made up that before he made up genital cutting. In reality, FGM can actually cause an intense amount of pain. It can cause severe problems urinating and having sex. It can cause hemorrhaging, infection, sterility, and it can even cause death. And it's been really difficult for activists to make positive changes in the communities where FGM is practiced. But there was an article recently in the New York Times. Celia Duggar wrote about a group called Tosten, which is spurring a movement in Senegal that seems to actually be working. And in the past, the efforts by activists have sort of come from outside, like the UN has been trying to raise funds. They have spent years trying to raise funds to help combat FGM, but they're only halfway to their goal. They just haven't really been very effective. But this is something that's coming up much more organically from the people living in Senegal. And what it involves is educating one village at a time, telling families there about the dangers of female genital mutilation, and educating the local moms that there's no religious requirement for the cutting. And they get everyone at once to pledge to stop cutting girls. And then what happens is word spreads from village to village via intermarrying couples. So it's actually working. It's becoming a huge campaign in Senegal, and tons of villages have already vowed to stop the cutting, and it's continuing to spread around. And the article in the Times makes a really interesting comparison to foot binding, and how it used to be that foot binding was a horrific practice, you know, that was done to women, and it would end up, you know, leave women crippled. And what happened in the late 19th century was basically getting people getting parents to pledge not to bind their daughters' feet, nor to allow their sons to marry women with bound feet. And the practice ended within a generation. So that's what they're doing now with female genital mutilation, and it seems to be working. So it's good news.
Yeah, it's excellent. I mean, it is. It's always still shocking. You know, obviously we're a bit isolated, you know, here in the West from such things, but there are still like barbaric practices like that going on in the world. And yeah, I do think it just makes like a concerted effort. Like it just has to become unacceptable that this is happening.
Yeah, and it's funny you should use that very specific phrase. And I think I have in the past too mentioned that FGM is barbaric. That's a phrase that's specifically called out as one that's not used when these when the people who are in these villages are going around trying to educate them, because they come from the same culture, they're much more sensitive to the way that the message will be received,
yeah.
And so they're careful not to, for instance, even use the term female genital mutilation, and they don't talk about the fact that it's barbaric. They simply point out that it's unhealthy, that it's killing girls, that it needs to stop, you know. And it's interesting because I think without people who are already within that culture, it would be impossible to really set up a positive dialogue, because, you know, we're speaking two different languages,
yeah.
You know, in every possible way. So this is a movement that's coming from within Senegal, and I think that's one of the main reasons why it's been so effective.
Yeah. Yeah, I do think that changes like that often have to come from within, because when the observation or the pressure comes from without, then there it does look like, you know, one culture criticizing the traditions of another culture.
Yeah. Right.
Someone forcing their beliefs upon
right.
another culture, and that
yeah.
doesn't fly.
And that's not to say that we shouldn't help at all. In fact, I think that Western organizations that are working on the ground in places like that need our help now more than ever. It's just that now they're getting a lot more support from people
yeah.
within the culture. So, you know, if you want to donate to one of the campaigns, organizations like UNICEF or Equality Now, people who are out there doing this work, it's probably very much appreciated now more than ever.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we talked about this a little bit before, just the basic notion of there are two ethical principles or moral principles, one of respect and tolerance of other cultures versus another ethical principle that's being violated by another culture, right? So we talked about this with cultures that are still hunting whales. It's like, well, you know, okay, we want to respect their traditions, right. But, you know, the whales are going extinct, so something's got to give. And here it's like, okay, we respect their culture, but this is mutilation that shouldn't be happening. So I think the good compromise is to try to convince them to change the practice from within.
But at some point, you just have to stop people from doing this type of thing as well. You know, you can't wait too long.
Well, yeah, and of course, I don't think anyone's advocating waiting. It's what it is more is a change of tactics. This the practice of female genital mutilation has actually been illegal in Senegal since I think the early 90s. I could be wrong about that, but it's been illegal for quite some time. But making something illegal and then enforcing it doesn't always, you know, making something illegal doesn't guarantee that it's going to be enforced. And enforcing it won't necessarily guarantee that you're not just fixing a symptom as opposed to the actual disease. Because what you really want to do is not just stop people from doing this one act, but you need to convince them that there's a good reason why. There's a health benefit to not doing that anymore. And that will actually improve everyone as opposed to just making that culture feel as though people in that culture from feeling oppressed. Instead, you know, you'll actually get them on your side. So I think it's just about tactics and about how do we convey a message that will hopefully improve, you know, the lives of the people in that culture.
So one more quick update. Evan, tell us about how Harold Camping's predictions are going.
Oh, yes, swimmingly. And as you know, he had to revise his doomsday prediction back in May, and he says now that the real end of the world is October 21st. So we're going to have more to say on that in the very near future.
Yes, of course, if you're listening to this, the world didn't end yesterday. But we haven't had time to hear what his rationalization is, but we'll report on that. Yeah, the cult's rationalization next week.
Yeah, well, the other option is that you were one of the saved, right? You did not sin. You met all the requirements of the rapture.
And apparently me, otherwise I wouldn't have been able to have time to do post-production on the podcast.
It's a very good point. Very good point. All right, a more thorough examination and taking apart of Harold Camping soon.
Okay, thanks, Evan. Well, Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
Thanks for reminding me, Steve. So let's get to it, and we'll play last week's Who's That Noisy?
All right, so what was that, Evan?
Well, that sort of, as someone described, a bunch of mice setting off a bunch of mouse traps, kind of noise, if you can picture that,
yep,
are popping wisteria seed pods.
Oh.
You know what wisteria seed pods are?
Yeah.
They're a member of the pea family that grows on this climbing vine, and they have nice flowers and stuff, but obviously these pea pods. And pressure builds up after time as it dries out on the inside, and then boom! These things explode in a very wide dispersal.
That's their seed dispersal strategy?
That is it, yes. And it's very effective, actually. The more they can spread out, the less they grow on top of each other, and they have more access to sun and so forth. It's all, you know.
Sounds like my honeymoon.
It's evolution. Evolution at work. That was submitted by a listener, Darren Bryant, from Spokane, Washington. And Darren was able to stump the audience. There was not a correct guess.
Awesome. Wow. Well done.
So very well done. And also I'm going to take this moment to credit from the week prior, Ben Etherington from Chicago, Illinois, who gave us the wonderful clip from Zaphod Beeblebrox IV.
Good job.
Which I forgot to do last week. So thank you, Ben, for that as well.
And what do you got for this week?
All right, here we go. This week's Who's That Noisy.
Ladies and gentlemen, the great Randy.
All right. Good one, Evan.
All right.
Aren't you going to say so good luck, everyone?
Yes. So send, take your best guess at that one. And don't forget to send it in to us at info@theskepticsguide.org or sign on to our forums and post your message there. Good luck, everyone.
I think someone will probably get that this week.
I think so.
We're sitting here now at TAM 9 with Richard Wiseman. Richard, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
It's a pleasure to be here. It's very nice.
It feels like we just spoke recently, but I don't think we've had you on the show, actually, for a couple of years.
No, a couple of years. I should apologize about my voice, first of all. I'm losing my voice.
What were you doing to it?
Well, it's TAM. It's TAM, mm-hmm. actually, yeah. Because I've been in lots of rooms where I've had to be shouting at people.
Yeah.
Mainly for them to leave me alone. and it's taken its toll, so I apologize. It means I sort of sound constantly highly emotional. Mm-hmm. But don't, you know, I'm not, I'm fine. No, someone's given me this, though, just as I walked in here, which is a cinnamon soothing throat spray.
Oh.
But I've never had dog urine in my mouth. I would imagine it tastes a lot like this cinnamon soothing throat spray. It is revolting.
Yep. You know, so you've tried the cinnamon soothing.
I tried it just before I walked in, and honestly, if a dog had urinated in my mouth, I would think it tastes the same way.
That's what I felt when Richard Saunders gave me that musk candy, remember?
I wonder how you're going to finish that when you said when Richard Saunders gave me. I was thinking, a big kiss on the lips. Anyway.
So, Richard, we saw your talk.
I'm so sorry.
No, it was...
I shouldn't have defecated into my hand and thrown it at the audience like that.
First of all, there was things in there that were absolutely... Everything to me was brand new. I hadn't seen any of that.
Oh, my goodness.
The pig picture...
Yes.
Speaking of filth, yes.
My fiance and I actually hurt each other laughing because my arm was around her. And
right.
We had like a laughing like tug of war, which was painful. That was ridiculous. I until you said what it was,
yeah.
I swear, it looked like it was in the act of something happening, if you
context
get my meaning.
For our listeners?
Yes.
There was a picture of two adult pigs with a baby pig in between them, and it looked like a man with his thighs up in the air and his personal
Johnson
standing straight at attention.
Okay.
Exactly thank like you that. Well, it's, you know,
it looks disgusting. It looks extremely rude.
Yes.
And then you tell people what it is, and it still looks fairly rude.
Yeah,
so, I like that. I like that picture.
Great.
Yeah,
Jay, you should read Richard Wiseman's blog, and you will get these every week.
That's right.
I absolutely do read his blog. I don't go every week because there's just too much skeptical material out there.
The Friday puzzle. What the hell?
But yeah. I reserve most of my Richard Wiseman time to his books.
Mm-hmm.
And now
like,
on to my next question.
Yes.
He writes books?
When we spoke last, which was a couple of weeks ago,
yeah.
I distinctly remember you saying, I will bring my books, which are not published in the United States,
yeah.
to you guys.
Yeah.
And I know you don't have any.
I've got one.
What does that mean?
I've got one book.
Oh, so you're out of luck, Jay. That one's mine.
I got one.
Okay.
Because why have I got one? I had to go and buy it. In the UK,
yeah,
because I actually don't have any copies, and so I went to buy it, and the woman where I bought it recognized me.
Yeah.
So I'm buying my own book in a bookstore, and she looked at me, and I looked at her, and it just went silent.
Yeah,
right.
It was a horrible moment.
You told her, don't tell anybody.
Yeah, it was horrible. So no, I've got that one because it was going to be a prize and a quiz here, but then PZ Myers won the quiz, and he's already got a copy.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't going to give him this copy. So I still got one copy left.
So what are you going to do with it?
I don't know, actually. I might auction it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
If you need like someone to read it, though,
yeah.
you let me know.
Yeah. It just comes down to money, really.
Yeah, I know.
That's just how much I'm prepared to give.
All right. So please turn that book into money for you, but please consider possibly sending us some copies.
Or you could download it from Kindle.
I know, yeah. But I want the book.
And this book is Paranormality, which is...
Bless you for mentioning it.
Yes.
Paranormality, my new book.
I know you're too big to mention your own book.
I would never do such a thing.
Yeah, you'll buy your own book, but you won't mention it.
Now, this is the book you wrote after 59 Seconds, another phenomenal Richard Wiseman book.
Oh, 230,000 copies sold in the UK. Yes.
Very nice.
Yes.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah, I bought most of them. It cost me a fortune. yes. Okay, it follows on the footsteps of 59 and looks at the psychology of the paranormal. Yeah. So I'm very excited about it.
So, yeah, you talked about it today during your talk a little bit.
A little bit.
Would you like to go into a little more detail? I actually had some questions. Now, one thing you do in the book is you do talk about why people believe in the paranormal.
Yep.
And why they're wrong.
Yep.
So let's start there.
So I looked around, and I couldn't find a single sort of book with all the kind of modern research in that was like a sort of skeptical primer, where you go, look, you know, you hear about out-of-body experiences and ghosts and people who seem to be able to predict the future. Here's the other side of the story. Here's the skepticism. So that's what's in Paranormality. The starting point for each chapter is none of this stuff is true. Mm-hmm. So you hear people having out-of-body experiences. They don't really leave their bodies. And ghosts don't exist either. So stop being silly. And let's have a look at the psychology of why people believe this. More importantly, why they experience it, and that's what the book goes into. So it's about, you know, what the paranormal tells us about ourselves.
So you don't waste any time, you know, being coy with the reader about what you think about these things. You say, just get it out of the way. They don't exist. Now let's.
It takes a grown-up attitude towards these things. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And because of that, the believers in the UK hate me even more than they did before.
Well, if they didn't hate you, you wouldn't be doing your job, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yes. Yeah. But they do hate me. So it takes something like ghosts, and it looks at suggestibility, it takes out-of-body experiences, how does your brain work out where you are at this particular moment. It takes things like precognition, looks at the law of large numbers, statistics, so it goes into all of these things.
So just to clarify, though, readers in the United States or in North America can buy it on Kindle and the Nook?
No, it's not on the Nook. There's no Nook.
No Nookie from you?
There's no Nookie on this. Now, is Nookie an American term? Would you understand
Nookie? Yeah, we know Nookie.
Oh, really?
We like Nookie.
Yeah. I thought that was a British term.
It probably it was, because most things that we do were British anyway.
Right.
That's right. So.
Right, there's no Nookie. There's a Kindle, and there's an iBook, and then there's a physical edition being shipped in from the UK. By my UK publishers, but no, the US publishers wouldn't touch it.
Okay, well, I suppose I could order it from a publisher in the UK and have them ship it to me.
If you really want that badly, then I'll arrange for.
Stop begging, Jay.
Yeah.
But the thing that you just glossed over here was that you publish. You're a successful author.
Very successful.
Very successful author. Yes.
Amazing.
Yes,
amazing.
J.K. Rowling successful.
Yeah. Not quite. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not get crazy. And you have a successful book in the UK. You've
Several.
Imported your latest one, Paranormality.
I see that one. Yes.
Just to that one now.
Yeah.
And you say, all right, I'm going to do like with all my other books, I'm going to import this into the United States and get a publisher to publish it there. And they said, no thanks.
That's great. We'll be translated into about 20 different languages, like all the other books. And then it came to selling it to the US, and there are six major publishers in the US. And they all said no, no serious offers. And I said, why? And they said, well, because there's no audience for this stuff. You've got to say this stuff is true. So could you change it a bit so that you say maybe ghosts exist or some psychics are psychic? And I said, no, that would be silly. So let's not do that. And then with the joys of Kindle, and iBooks and Nookie, then you can start to publish yourself, and it's happening more and more these days. It's very exciting.
Well,
I'm
good
excited.
It serves them right to getting bypassed, because they would not publish the book. But it still is amazing that they thought that there's no market for the science of the paranormal.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy.
Well, it's also interesting because in America, there's such large belief in the stuff, because those two things may well be related. So you have around about 80-90% of people believing in some sort of paranormal or magical phenomena. So huge levels compared to about 40-50% in the UK. And it's an industry. You know, psychic hotlines, you have these ghost hunting shows on television.
But you guys have rugby, so it's all...
That's true.
Yeah.
Oh, I hate rugby. Oh. So that's out there. And I think there's a vested interest in not people not hearing the other side of the story, particularly when it comes to going to a psychic, where the book lays out all this kind of mind tricks that psychics use, and I went into all the sort of DVDs and training courses and so on that fake psychics go on. And that's upset a lot of people. And I think there's money in them, their heels, so people don't want customers knowing.
Now, that's an American saying.
Them, their hills.
Them, their hills.
There's Nookie and them, their hills.
Exactly.
Bridge that gap. It's a gift.
Right.
So one other thing I'd like to comment on your talk today at TAM was, it was brilliantly funny. I was actually telling Hugo, who's a stage manager here, I said, I'm really nervous about going on after Richard because there was like a quick break between your talk and then the second SGU show. And like you had people laughing on average about every 10 to 15 seconds, and they were real laughs. It wasn't chuckles. It was audience-wide laughs. So it was brilliant. I loved it. It was very good.
Well, I only had half an hour, so I kind of condensed everything down. And I think you have to justify, with a large crowd, you have to justify every single second of it in my head. So yeah, if something interesting isn't happening within 20 seconds, then I get very nervous.
Yeah.
So either there'll be a point being made or a new slide or something funny or a remark or whatever. So you're really, really banging it through, yeah.
I like that. I think the punchier it is, the more people feel attached to you and what you're saying. When you get those long moments at a talk, you know, as soon as you lose people, even for a moment, you could feel the room change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And energy is very important. And also, with this particular crowd, was kind of interesting because it took a little while to get them. It was probably, if you listen back, it's probably only about sort of 10, 12 minutes in that they start to get it. So it took a little while to build. But yeah, it was in there. It was all right.
We've been talking to a lot of the speakers here about, you know, how to get science across to the public. And one of the themes that keeps coming across over and over again, like with Bill Nye and Neil deGrasse Tyson, for example, is that they actually deliberately have developed the skill set of being entertaining and to use that as a vehicle for teaching science and skepticism. So, of course, this is, I think, what everyone's interested in. So you obviously fit that mold as well. I mean, joking aside, you're fabulously entertaining on stage and the information that you're conveying. So how much of that was a really like a deliberate work on your part, or are you just a naturally funny guy?
I'm naturally hilarious.
Yes.
My friends often will say, you're very, very funny.
Yeah.
At a party or something. They'll say, you're a very funny man. Very funny, like that. They'll do that. They're very funny. They're the second bit. You're very funny.
You're a witty chap.
Witty chap. I have background in magic. And so you think about everything, and I speak a lot. I think that's the answer. I think the answer is to get out and do it a lot. So I give two talks like that a week. Mm-hmm. Not to this, actually, I mean, that's 1,500 people. That's a big talk. But in front of me. So I get that opportunity to change things and just get the nuance. You know, just so with the Piglet picture, it's got to come up first of all. People have got to be shocked by it. You've got to have that moment. And then I say, you know, it's just a piglet between two pigs. I'm disgusted that you thought that way.
Yeah.
When obviously I'm the one that's put the picture up, right. So it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So then you get the second laugh. And then there's a follow-up, which is, you know, I've done research, and for 84.2% of you tonight, this image will appear in your dreams.
Yeah.
So from that one slide, there's three moments in it. And, you know, it didn't start off like that. It just started with me putting up the piglet slide.
Yeah.
So these things, you know, it's evolve.
So just like a comedian. Or anybody that's on a stage frequently, right? You're honing it as you go.
Yeah, and off that stuff comes under fire. It's very hard to think of that when you're just sort of sitting in your living room. It comes when you're standing there. So there's a line about Mormon teenagers where I say, God's really angry because they're getting off on a technicality. That line came to me when I'm standing in the Bloomsbury Theatre in front of 500 people. You think that's the perfect way to end that particular routine so it sticks in.
Yeah.
So all these little things, I mean, the answer is just get out there and do it. That's the answer.
It always boils down to the hard work.
And it's okay to try and fail. Right? You figure out what works, what doesn't work.
Yeah.
And then you'll make your judgment. You can't be afraid to fail, I guess is the point.
Well,
it
depends when you fail. So, it's a very old showbiz tip. You know, you start and you end with strong material, stuff you've done a million times before. And a few people came up to me afterwards and said, oh, that opening routine, we've seen that loads of times. And you think, yeah, I know. But that's kind of securing your beachhead before you start the invasion inland.
Yeah.
You want that because you don't want to start with something that does fail because then it's a real uphill struggle. Mm. So all of the new material always goes into that center section so that whatever, you know, you can always pick it up at the end. So it's that sort of stuff, yeah.
That's right. And you just learned, did you learn most of that just being a performer as a magician?
Or? I think it's just being sensible about it. And probably walking out a few times with some great opening lines that died. And then you think, now it's a struggle.
Yeah.
So in fact, actually what happened here, I started and the mic wasn't turned on.
Yeah.
And that's a dodgy start. You don't want to start like that.
I'm shocked. There were technical difficulties for your lecture here?
Unbelievable. Actually, the AV's been very good here. But so that's a start. So you use the old trick of, George, can you come back on and introduce me again? Crowd, can you make a big noise? Because then you've lifted the energy right up, and now, bang, you can go straight into it. You don't really want to be starting with a microphone that's a bit dodgy, and now it's all a little bit fragile at the beginning. You want something solid. So you step back, and then you go back into it a second time.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And these are old performer tricks.
Yeah. Right. Hmm. What's your typical day like?
Well, so my existence is slightly bizarre. I'm split between London and Edinburgh. And when I'm in London, I'm normally doing sort of media stuff. And in Edinburgh, I write. And so I have an office in my flat in Edinburgh, and I get out of bed and put on some clothes, and then I go across the corridor into my office, and most of the time, it's about 4 or 5 months of the year, I will write mm-hmm. in there, and then the other few months are promoting those books and doing research.
So you work for yourself?
No, I work for the University of Hertfordshire. Okay. So I'm a professor, but it's a professor of public understanding of science. So I do a lot of public lectures, do research and publish it, and give some lectures, student lectures as well.
Cool.
Yeah, all in that room. They all come in. It's great. Yeah. So like anybody, any other writer who spends a lot of time on their own, download an enormous amount of pornography. Mm-hmm. Colossal.
Now you're talking Jay's language.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you teach a course at the university, or is it just standalone lectures?
I can find almost any clip.
Yeah.
Involving goats.
It's called Chuffing 101 by
Chuffing 101.
Chuffing with goats.
Chuffing with goats.
Yeah, what are the experiments?
The men who chuff at goats.
He teaches his students how to find the exact type of porn they're looking for in the shortest amount of time.
Exactly.
And there is a formula to it, if you didn't know, which we can show you later.
No, I do teach. So I teach on psychology of performance. Mm-hmm. So I do stuff on magic and performance. And
that must be an awesome course.
It's all right. It's quite fun. Yeah.
Well, what's the feedback you get from your students? You must get that.
Well, you know. It's mixed. Some of them like it. There have been complaints. I don't think they can be upheld. But, you know, the judge said I had to be careful. So, it's all fun and games. I do some teaching, but predominantly it's public education stuff.
So you mentioned mm-hmm. before you're doing about 2 talks a week.
Yeah.
So, where are you doing these, and where are they typically held?
All over the place. What am I doing as soon as I get back? I'm going on holiday, actually, as soon as I get back. I'm quite looking forward to that. It's mm-hmm. my first holiday in 6 years.
Where are you going?
I'm going to Morocco, going to Marrakesh.
Ooh,
excellent.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm quite excited.
You're working on a book project now?
I am.
What's coming after Paranormality?
Well, I've got one more book to do. Mm-hmm. And that will be finished in December. So I'm very excited. I can't say what it is. There's a big secret thing on it. But that's a psychology book, mm-hmm. As you might expect. And that will come out in July in the UK. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's back to the PC.
Cool.
Yeah. Very exciting.
Awesome.
Now, if I had just finished a book, I would be carrying around a copy of it with me at all times.
Yeah, to give to people.
Well, no, I'm not going there again.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it would be such an accomplishment to me. Yeah. I would want to have it physically with me for a little while. But I noticed that you're not carrying your book around.
No, what was the first book I did? Luck Factor. The first time I went to a bookstore and saw it on the shelf, it was such a mammoth moment. Yeah. It was like, oh my goodness, look, it's over there.
Yeah.
The shelf is full of them.
Why is nobody buying these? Yeah. That was very exciting. And then the second time, which was Quirkology, it was like, oh, that's quite nice. And then it's like a thing where you kind of get used to it a bit. And someone said to me, it's in the corridor outside, they said, 1,600 people, you walk out, that's got to be a buzzy moment.
Yeah.
And you think, actually, you know, as long as there's no sort of AV problems and so on, it's pretty, so you get used to these things. It sounds a bit glib.
No, it doesn't. We understand. I mean, when we first came to TAM and we had our first, you know, experience with people listening to the show, and it was, you know, we didn't expect anything. We just, you know, we wanted to be a part of TAM and be, you know, part of the audience as well, and you know, just experience it. But we had people like, oh, well, you know, really gushing and loving the show and all that stuff, and it was so weird. Like, it just didn't seem right. Like, you know, wait a minute, this is just, we're the idiots, and, you know, they're brothers and mm-hmm. friends. They're just recording, like, our conversations. Like, they're, you know, and then after a while, a couple of years, and you're like, it's just a part of the landscape now, you know?
Well, it just shows how good we are at habituating to whatever mm-hmm. happens to us. Because mm-hmm. That can be a problem, because, you know, you buy a new car and you get excited for a week, and then you want an even bigger one, and same in the house and so on, you get that sort of hedonistic treadmill. So the religious idea of reminding yourself how grateful you should be for what you've got, actually, I think it's pretty sound psychology.
Yeah. Right.
So there are moments when I sort of think, oh, hold on a second, I make my living by writing what I find about what I find absolutely fascinating and then going out and telling people about it. Could life be any better?
Yeah, and they enjoy hearing you talk. You know?
Well, they seem to. They invite me back and things. And you think, no, it could not be any better than that. And you've got to remind yourself about that. So, yeah, I consider myself very fortunate in that sense.
Yeah, we do too. I mean, just being able to have the joy of recording the show together because we love interacting with each other. You know, like, in a way, it's like we used to play video games with each other and then we're always going out to dinner together and spending time. Yeah. But doing something constructive that we all believe in and, to a cause that has incredible meaning to us is awesome. That alone is worth it.
Yep.
And we wouldn't have been able to get through our first 3 years if we weren't just enjoying the process of what we do. But then, now you start adding in events and all the friends and like people like you that we get to meet and spend time with and everything. And it's just beyond any of my expectations I had of myself 20 years ago. Like, I didn't think anything like this would happen.
Yeah. And it shows that for others, I mean, it's all achievable. It's all doable.
Yep. Right.
And you have to remind yourself, I mean, when I walk out on stage, and in fact, I did it today, you kind of think you want to make this special for people. You don't want it to be like the same talk. That talk I gave last week twice. You don't want it to feel like you're on a treadmill and what goes through your head. So I stood in the wings thinking, these people, it's 1,600 people, whatever it is, are paying quite a reasonable amount of money to be here. How fantastic is that? That they've got so much passion for skepticism and science. They're prepared to put their hand in their pocket, come along to an event to hear scientists. How special is it for me? What an honor it is for me to walk out and address their audience. It doesn't get any better than that. That's just fantastic. So that's what's going through my head. So that when you walk out, it's like you're in the moment. You're in the moment with that group.
Yeah.
Well, Richard, it's always a pleasure. We're happy to see you again. But we love having you sit down with us.
And it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much. Paranormality out now on the Kindle. For goodness sake, buy it.
Please do.
Yes.
Go blimey. Thank you, Richard.
Bye-bye.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week?
Yes.
Indeed. Ooh,
yeah. Jay, you're a little out of practice.
I've been out of practice all year, Steve.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe that'll have a positive effect.
Yeah, you never know. All right, here we go. Ready? Item number one, results of a new analysis of dwarf galaxies is incompatible with existing models of dark matter. Item number two, researchers have demonstrated that they can use computerized word analysis to predict recidivism in criminals up for parole with a greater than 70% accuracy. Item number three, a UK study finds that 1 in 6 mobile phones is contaminated with fecal matter.
Oh, my God.
All right, Jay, go first.
All right, first one. The results of a new analysis of dwarf galaxies is incompatible with existing models of dark matter. I have no information on that. It could, the dark matter is so weird, you know. Researchers have demonstrated that they can use computerized word analysis to predict recidivism in criminals. What is that, Steve?
That means that they will go. They slide backwards. They'll go on again to commit crimes.
70% accuracy. Wow. Computerized word analysis to figure that out? That seems amazingly high. The last one, a UK study finds that 1 in 6 mobile phones is contaminated with fecal matter. Of course they are. Of course. I'll admit it now. I mean, I've used my phone while I was on the toilet. I have. It's like, it's the most entertaining thing that I own. So, so that one's definite. So now we're down between the first one and the second one. I don't know anything about the first one, so I'm going to definitely say that the recidivism one, the 70% accuracy, is the fake.
Okay, Bob.
The dwarf galaxy is incompatible with existing models of dark matter. I mean, what aspect of the model, I wonder? I don't know. I kind of get the sense, though, that they haven't done a lot of surveys of dark matter with dwarf galaxies, and specifically, maybe they can do it now that their instrumentation is more sensitive, and maybe that's why this is arising now. But I just don't know much about that. It's possible. Maybe there's something about the relatively lower gravitational gravity well for dwarf galaxies that make it different. I'm not sure about that one. Yeah, the computerized word accuracy, that does sound very high. What would it be? What would there be about the word analysis? I just don't see any connection between word usage and recidivism. All right, the mobile phones with the contaminated with fecal matter. Yeah, I can kind of buy that. I remember a study from a long time ago that that examined like toothbrushes and contamination of fecal matter. And pretty much, if the toothbrush is anywhere near the toilet, it is going to be a detectable amount of fecal matter on it, which was kind of disconcerting. But I mean, we're talking minute amounts, and that's the key thing about this is how do you define contaminated? I mean, is it detectable? Is it at the level of detectability? I mean, I'm sure it's relatively insignificant. But based on that study I've heard about years ago, I'm going to kind of makes that plausible to me. The dark matter seems plausible as well. So I'm going to have to say that the recidivism is the fiction.
Okay, Evan?
The dwarf galaxies. I know very little about dwarf galaxies. And how incompatible with existing models of dark matter. I'm going to be curious to hear how exactly. I'm sure it is fascinating. The mobile phones and the fecal matter, yep. Yeah. The study revealed that, and it's probably even worse than that. I mean, you know, just because the study's too limited, it's probably even worse. So I'm not surprised there. This whole computerized word analysis, this smacks of, I don't know, you know, polygraphs in a sense, right? I mean, or handwriting analysis, this kind of stuff. And that number 70% seems to be too high. I agree with the other gentleman. I have to go with that one being the fiction.
Okay, Rebecca.
Yep. Me too.
There it is.
There she blows.
I don't really have much to...
All right. Remember,
something funny to say about fecal matter?
Random guessing is 50%, so 70% is not that much better.
Like, of course there's fecal matter on everything you own, so just forget about it.
Hurry up. Yeah. Hurry up, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Your keyboard, my God. Don't even think about what is on your computer keyboard.
Don't lick your
moment.
Keyboard? Is that your advice for the day?
That's my advice for every day.
That's a bumper sticker.
Dark matter, yeah, the dark matter is deeply mysterious, and who knows what the hell. Like, they're going to be revising our models of dark matter for quite a while, so that makes perfect sense to me. So that leaves this idea that, you know, word analysis, 70% accuracy, that's a ridiculously high level of accuracy that I don't buy for a minute.
All right. So you guys seem the most confident about number three. A UK study finds that 1 in 6 mobile phones is contaminated with fecal matter.
Mobile phones, too.
And that one is science.
Disgusting science.
Yeah, I don't really want to say hooray to that.
I actually thought 1 in 6 seemed low. I would expect even higher than that.
Yeah, but the specifically by contamination, they mean that they were able to find E. coli.
Oh,
on the phones, which comes from fecal matter.
And is that from me using it when I'm on the toilet?
Or just not washing your hands? You know, in handling your cell phone and going to the bathroom without washing your hand with soap.
Then why don't we have more cases of E. coli contamination and sickness in people?
Yeah, that's right. Well, we do. I mean, you know, it is a common pathogen that we pass hand to mouth, unfortunately. They said, although 95% of people said they washed their hands with soap where possible, 92% of phones and 82% of hands had bacteria on them. That's not surprising. But 16% of hands and 16% of phones were found to have E. coli, which comes from only one place. So bacteria of fecal origin. There are different types of E. coli. Some are more harmful than others. But generally speaking, you don't want to get them into your orifices other than the one where they come from. This news item was released actually in preparation for National Hand Washing Day, which we talked about last week. And this is one of the reasons why this is one of the situations where you do want to wash your hands thoroughly with soap after being in a restroom situation.
Now I want to wash my phone.
And your phone, yeah. I have access to alcohol pads, you know, in the clinic where I work, so it's easy just to Plus, I'm always washing my hands or using the hand sanitizer.
Yeah,
because it's ubiquitous now in clinic situations. So, yeah, I wipe down my instruments, my phone, everything.
Settle down.
Wax the dolphin.
Polish my cell phone. Evan, I am appalled, as Richard Wiseman would say. I am absolutely appalled. All right, let's go to number one. Results of a new analysis of dwarf galaxies is incompatible with existing models of dark matter. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is...
Yes.
Science.
Science.
Don't get ahead of yourselves there. This one is also science. So, Bob, have you read this one?
Yeah, I did.
Okay. So...
I read it too. Give me a little credit.
All right. I know. I told you this was going to be easy this week.
All you reading people.
So dark matter, as most of our listeners probably know, is the extra matter out there that we can't see that is providing the extra gravity that we measure when we calculate how fast galaxies are rotating and how fast they should be rotating based upon the matter that we can see. We say, there's got to be some extra gravity in there. There's something else providing gravity that is dark, hence dark matter. We're not exactly sure what dark matter is, but there are some theories. Astronomers have used computer models to predict where the dark matter would go and what structures it would form if dark matter is comprised of cold material, meaning that it's not very hot, I guess.
Wow, thanks for that expert insight.
Yeah, thank you. Meaning slow moving. And the computer models say that it should be clumping in the middle of the galaxy. So they looked at dwarf galaxies. They chose dwarf galaxies because they have a very large proportion of dark matter to visible matter. They don't have that many stars. And what they found is that the dark matter appears to be uniformly distributed throughout the galaxy, not clumped in the middle. So that the observation is incompatible with the existing computer models of how cold dark matter should be behaving. So this means one of two things that the astronomers have been able to figure out so far. Either dark matter is not cold, or two, it's interacting with normal matter differently than we assumed.
So dark matter just got darker.
Yeah, it's even more mysterious than we thought it was. Of course, there are those who might say, well, maybe there isn't dark matter. Maybe it's all, modified Newtonian dynamics. But I think that's pretty much been put to bed. That's not the sole explanation. There's got to be, like, the bullet cluster we always bring up.
Exactly. Yep.
I also think if just what they're saying about dwarf galaxies, if dwarf galaxies have a different proportion of dark matter to visible matter, that also kind of calls into question it all being modified Newtonian dynamics, basically modifications of gravity. It's got to be a thing, right? If there could be different amount of it in relation to regular matter.
Sounds reasonable.
Yeah, whatever. That's my understanding anyway. So, but that's pretty cool. So all of this means that researchers have demonstrated that they can use computerized word analysis to predict recidivism in criminals up for parole with a greater than 70% accuracy is complete fiction.
But I'll bet you someone thought it was right and wrote a report on it, right?
No. I based it loosely on a different news item involving computerized word analysis. This was not as – well, it's hard to – I decided not to use this as a real news item just because it's – kind of like a preliminary study, but they what they looked at is they took psychopaths, which I find fascinating, by the way, especially after reading John Ronson's book, The Psychopath Test, which we interviewed him about, and they took criminals, non-psychopathic violent criminals, and they had them recount their crimes, then they transcribed them, and then they did word analysis, like a computerized word analysis on their first-person description of their crimes that they committed. And what they found was that the psychopaths used cause-and-effect descriptors more often than the non-psychopaths, words like because or since, meaning, and they interpret this as that they were making more effort to justify their actions. Although the degree to which that was increased was it was statistically significant, but it was tiny. It was like 1.8 versus 1.5% of the words that they used. So I wasn't too impressed with that. They focused on material needs, food, drink, and money, twice as much as non-psychopaths. That was a little bit more of a reasonable effect size. And fewer references to social needs, family, religion, and spirituality, which fits the description of psychopaths that they are more focused on basic physical needs and less on so-called higher social needs. They also used more disfluencies like or which was interpreted as they were expending more cognitive energy describing their crime, maybe because they were trying to they were spending more time trying to spin it in a certain way, right? So they were trying to describe it in a way that was more favorable to them as opposed to just saying what happened. But that's very speculative. So the study's interesting. I found it very speculative, and it also I would be more impressed if they then did the obvious next step, which is take psychopaths and non-psychopaths as unknowns and see if the computer can tell you which one's a psychopath and which one isn't. Now, that doesn't necessarily flow from this kind of data. We've talked about this before as well. The fact that there are statistical differences between psychopaths and non-psychopaths doesn't mean that you can look at an individual. This is the inherent problem with lie detectors. There may be statistical differences in what our brains do and what words we use when we're lying. That doesn't mean that you can tell when an individual is lying with any kind of sensitivity or specificity. So it may not work going backwards, but it would be real interesting to see if it does or to what extent it does. But anyway, I didn't use it as a real one because I thought it was a little bit speculative for that, but it was interesting. Good work, everybody. You guys had no problem sniffing out the fake this week.
Yeah.
Thank you, Steve.
Oh, yeah.
You'll have to try harder
with the fecal
next
matter.
I will. You know. Yeah, I knew. I had to use that one, but I knew that was going to be a giveaway. So, Jay.
Yes.
I know you're right, fresh off the plane almost from your honeymoon, but did you manage to scare up a quote for us this week?
Yeah, I have two quotes.
Two? Oh, wow.
Yeah, one that is non-skeptical from Michelangelo. And Michelangelo said, "If people knew how hard I work to get my mastery, it wouldn't seem so wonderful at all." And sure. I thought that was interesting because he created the Pietà in the Sistine Chapel when he was 24 years old, and he was already a master at 24. But indeed, he did work incredibly hard at his skill.
Yeah.
And earned his place in history partly because of his hard work and partly because he's a freak. He was born a freakishly good at anything that he tried. So thank you, Michelangelo.
Buonanotte.
I have another quote. This is a quote I never would have found if it weren't for a listener named Derek Billings from Bloomington, Illinois. It's a very interesting quote from the movie and the book and I believe the play Shogun.
Oh.
How baffling it was that even the most cunning and clever people would frequently see only what they wanted to see and would rarely look beyond the thinnest of facades. Or they would ignore reality, dismissing it as the facade. And then, when their whole world fell to pieces, they would tear their topknots or rend their clothes and bewail their karma, blaming gods or Cammy or luck or their lords or husbands or vassals, anything or anyone, but never themselves. James Clavell from Shogun. James Clavell!
That is a very good quote. It's very skeptical. Well, it's good to have the whole gang back together. Jay, it's good to have you back from Italy.
Thank you. Thank you.
This is a good time to remind our listeners that the gift-giving season is coming up. And what better gift to give to somebody than the gift of skepticism?
What better
that,
gift?
That's cheesy.
Wow.
That's what you want.
Hallmark-esque.
You can go to skepticalrobot.com and buy all kinds of skeptical swag to give to your friends, family, and loved ones. And you can also go to our store on our page, on the homepage, the SGU. Go to the store button, and you can see not only a link to the Skeptical Robot, but also to Cafe Press. You can also purchase our SGU Uncut special episodes. And I'll also remind everybody, this does make an excellent gift. You can purchase Medical Myths in DVD or CD from the Teaching Company. This is a 24-lecture series hosted by your humble host. You can either get an audio or video available from the Teaching Company. There is a link to that both on Neurologica as well as on our store page.
Good job.
Thank you. Thank you. I know. I should have been a salesman. I should get like a second job on QVC. What do you call that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I could totally see you on QVC. Next up, we have the gift for the skeptic in your life. It's a podcast. You can hear it. You can give.
Thanks for joining me again, guys.
Shirley,
thank you.
It was fun.
I'm back.
Jay is back.
Jay is back.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.